This is Digital Story Podcast number 1042, March 10th, 2026. Today's theme is it time to reconsider the bridge camera? I'm Derek Story. Last week, I talked about small sensor cameras in general and how they can pack a big punch in a small package. This week, I want to reintroduce you to the high magnification bridge camera that leverages small sensors to a 600 millimeter extreme and beyond. You'll be amazed at the images you can create with them. All of that, plus industry news on today's TDS Photography Podcast. I hope you enjoy the show. You may have a photographic gem stashed in the back of your closet right now and not even realize it. Bridge cameras were quite popular a decade ago for their compact size and impressive telephoto reach. But as larger sensor mirrorless cameras became more capable and sophisticated, most companies stopped producing the super telephoto compacts. Why? Because those small sensors could not compete with the likes of a full-frame mirrorless. But as I discussed last week, advances in AI-powered software have breathed new life into bridge cameras. Last month, it was about a month ago, I think, Rob and I were talking about this topic, and it came up in the context of our upcoming workshop to Costa Rica. And we were also talking about the Backyard Birds webinar. And so we're going on about, you know, what is the basic equipment you should have for either one of those events? What is a nice rig to have? And then what would be, you know, kind of a top of the line situation? And quite honestly, there was some serious investment involved once you got anything beyond basic. Now, the good news is if you have a full-frame sensor camera, you know, a Sony, a Nikon, Canon, a Panasonic full-frame, and you have the big gun glass to go with it, you have a very good chance of getting some super high-quality images that are absolutely beautiful. There's no doubt about it that combination of camera, sensor, and optics can really lead to some impressive photographs. And the other thing about those rigs is that you can still get impressive photographs even when the lighting is not perfect. Let's say, you know, we're talking about under the jungle canopy in Costa Rica, you know, suddenly you're dropping many EVs there, right? It's not like being outside at all. It's much darker in there. And so something that doesn't have the light gathering power, like a full frame sensor and a, you know, wide aperture lens, well, you know, is going to be difficult. It's going to be difficult, and these objects are moving, right? So that compounds the problem. However, there are a lot of situations when you're not under a canopy, right? And you're in nice bright sunlight, and especially when we're talking about using a long telephoto lens, a lot of times you're out in the open, you know, you're out trying to take pictures of, you know, big mammals, you know, moose or deer or whatever, or birds that are in daylight or any of that kind of stuff. It could be any number of things, but you have light to work with, right? Because wildlife usually doesn't exist inside your house at night. If it does, it's more of a domestic version, more like your cat. And in that case, of course, then you're going to pull out a different camera than a compact super zoom. My point being, there are situations where these smaller sensor bridge cameras really can do a good job. So we were talking about this and talking about the possibility of bringing one to Costa Rica. And I was thinking, you know what? I'm very interested in that. So, of course, Rob, who has a full-frame Sony camera, and he has the glass already, the big glass already, he's not interested in that. I mean, he's interested in talking about it, but he's not interested in investing in it. I am more around the 400 millimeter range, so I don't have those extra 200 millimeters or so. And I am interested in it because I don't shoot wildlife all the time. But when I'm out and about in nature, sometimes I do want to have the reach to get those kinds of shots. I was thinking, well, I am interested in this, and especially based upon my experiences, you know, with the TG series of cameras with their small sensors. And like I talked about last week, how much good stuff I've been able to get out of those cameras. I'm going, well, that's about the same size sensor that's in these bridge cameras, and I get that same kind of quality out of them. So then I became curious. I wanted to know, you know, what this is all about. So Rob and I kept talking about it, and he's going, you know, there was a camera that they loaned me once. Panasonic loaned me once when I was an ambassador for them. And it was very interesting. And it had a Leica lens, and, you know, he went on to describe it. And he says, let me find it for you. So he looked it up, and it was the Panasonic Lumix FZ300. And it came out in 2015, so about a decade ago, October, I believe, of 2015. I started doing some research on it, and I go, you know what? That does look interesting. So I found one on the used market in excellent shape for not very much money, and I bought it, and I started testing it. And that is what led to this podcast, because this is a camera that weighs 1.5 pounds, and on its longest dimension is about 5 inches. So basically, it fits anywhere. You can just drop it in my camera bag, yet it has a telephoto lens, a zoom lens, that goes out to 600 millimeters, and it has a constant aperture of f2.8. And it's a Leica lens on there. So 600 millimeters, f2.8, Leica glass. I go, how can I pass this up? I need to test this. So I did. I got it, and I have it, and I've had it for a couple weeks now, and I've been shooting with it, and I'm going, man, I have got to talk about this. So let me just tell you a little bit more about this specific camera, even though there are many like it in the world of bridge cameras. But this is the one that I have right now, so this is the one that I'll talk about, and then you can extrapolate from there. When Panasonic introduced the Lumix DMC FZ300 in July 2015, Camera Labs wrote it was an attractive proposition for anyone looking for a higher-end super zoom without breaking the bank. And when they said super zoom, they weren't kidding. The FZ300 features a 25 to 600 millimeter f2.8 constant aperture Leica lens. And at the time, for less than $600. Now, on the used market, mine was about $450 for excellent condition. In addition to that Leica glass, the FZ300 featured 5-axis image stabilization, 4K video, 4K photo, a high-performance electronic viewfinder, high-speed autofocus, 1 centimeter macro, weather sealing, and a lot more. All of this technology squeezed into a body that was only about 5 inches wide and weighs a mere 1.5 pounds. Sounds like a dream machine come true, right? So why don't we see them today? Well, that demure 1 over 2.3-inch 12-megapixel BSI CMOS sensor lacked the image quality and high ISO performance of the emerging wave of full sensor wonders. The irony was, and still is, those small sensors were the very thing that made the seemingly impossible 600 millimeter reach of the compact FZ300 possible. To achieve that magnification with a full-frame camera would require optics much larger and more expensive. So the cameras with the small sensors that bridged the transition from smartphone photography to DSLRs, they fell out of favor. And Panasonic never released a successor to the FZ 300. What they did go on to do was design and release a full-frame sensor camera to complement their Micro Four Thirds line. So now Panasonic mainly is focusing on, I mean, they have a few offshoots, but mainly the full-frame camera line and then the Micro Four Thirds camera line. And their bridge cameras, there's been nothing new in that area for some time. So that is that particular camera. And I'll be honest with you, the constant aperture Leica lens that reaches 600 millimeters had a lot to do with me giving this thing a try, regardless of the size of the sensor. So why could this camera and its brethren make sense again? The evolution of hardware technology contributed to the demise of bridge cameras, but changes in software may lead to their comeback. The issue of image quality and pixel count from small sensors is real, no doubt. Compared to a modern full-frame sensor, a chip smaller than your fingernail just can't compete, especially in low light conditions. Yet, somehow, the images from our smartphones with their minute chips are nothing short of amazing. How is this so? Well, the answer is software combined with clever merging techniques can help compensate for the lack of chip size. Interestingly enough, much of this technology is available to us today through software applications such as Lightroom, DxO PhotoLab, Photomator, Nitro, Luminar, and others. AI-powered noise reduction and resolution enhancement can bring those 12-megapixel photos up to a reasonable size and quality. And even though those same technologies can be applied to full-frame cameras, that's a level of quality that many of us don't often need. Some of us still like the idea of a compact camera with exceptional reach and reasonable image quality. Software to help those cameras compete with large sensor cameras wasn't really available in 2015, but it is today. So let's see what we can do with those bridge camera pictures. Here are a few things that I learned while shooting with this camera. Now, obviously, having worked with small sensor cameras before, I had a pretty strong starting point. It wasn't like I was just starting in the dark, so to speak. And the first thing is, of course, lots of light. As much light as you can get really has a big impact on the performance of this camera and cameras like it. Now, yes, the constant aperture f2.8 lens helps, but still, you want to be outside in daylight. This is not an existing light camera for dark hallways at 10 o'clock at night. This is for standing out in a field, taking pictures of, you know, beautiful animals during the day. It's more that kind of thing. But these are the times when we most often want a 400 to 600 millimeter telephoto anyway. Just like I talked about last week, I have had great success by adding a filter to the camera. What I'm using, well, there's two filters that I use. The one that I have on the camera right now is the Polar Pro Everyday Short Stash, and that is a 1/4 black diffuser and polarizer all in one filter, right? It's a combo filter, and it's fantastic. The other one that costs less is the K&F Concept 1/4 black diffuser plus circular polarizer, and you've heard me talk about these before, but there's something about these types of filters that make the images look better. I don't know if the polarizer helps, you know, bring the lights and darks more into a manageable range for the sensor, and the diffuser takes a little bit of the edge off the smaller pixels. I don't know exactly the physics of it, but I know what my eyes see, and my eyes think the pictures are better when I use these. And of course, when you're out in daylight, the two stops that's going to cost you really doesn't make any difference. Still, even at ISO 100, let's say on the last shoot, and I'll have pictures for you to look at because I have an article and I'll get to that in a minute. I'm still shooting ISO 100, 1/250th of a second at f4, that kind of thing, no problem all the time, and that's with the filter on. So I think that type of filter has been a big part of my satisfaction with the images coming out of the camera. Now, of course, when it's time to retreat indoors or evening conditions, either I have to add a supplemental light, I obviously have to take off the filter, and it's really time to switch cameras. So that's when I want to go with my OM3, my Nikon ZF, you know, one of those cameras that's much better suited for those conditions. However, I don't have a 600 millimeter lens for either of those cameras. So when I'm out in daylight and I have enough light, the Lumix just makes so much sense. Now, the other thing is shooting RAWs, and as you know, I prefer RAW plus JPEG. The JPEGs, of course, you know, whatever sort of film simulation or something you're doing, that's applied to JPEG. But I've noticed that when I'm using these AI technologies in the software programs like Nitro, like Photomator, like Luminar Neo, that they're really tuned to the RAW files, to the RAW profiles. And you can get so much more out of it. Now, because I do shoot RAW plus JPEG, I'm looking at both of them, right? Because I have two different versions of the same shot, the JPEG and the RAW. After I run the RAW through the fine tuning of a RAW processor and add whatever I'm going to add to it, and then compare it to the JPEG, there's absolutely more detail than with the JPEG itself. JPEGs look good and they're great for a lot of uses, but a lot of times when we're shooting wildlife, whether it be birds or animals with fur or whatever, that little extra detail that you get out of the RAW file, especially when you process it with this modern software I'm talking about, really shows those feathers better. They show the fur better. The eyes look better. You know, there's just that notch that it's better. And this is a case where I think RAW files are really important with this type of camera and with cameras that are like it. To see for yourself, I wrote an article and I've published it on LiveView. And the article's titled "How Bridge Cameras Got Lost in the Shuffle." And you can see the last shoot that I did with the FZ300. Now, I put a free link in the show notes to that article, so you can read it and enjoy it. There's no cost. You don't have to sign up for anything, nothing like that. Just use that link and it'll take you right over to the article. And you can see what I'm talking about because I shot flamingos and lemurs in that photo shoot. And so the lemurs obviously have fur. Flamingos obviously have feathers, and I think it's a nice look at what this camera can do. Will those shots blow away a full-frame Sony camera or a full-frame Nikon or Canon? No, no way. But do these images make good prints, and will they render well on a computer screen? Absolutely. I think they do. And again, this entire rig that I shot those shots with is about a pound and a half. And a mere 5 inches wide. I'm not saying that I would dare travel all the way to Costa Rica with only the FZ300, but I will have it in my bag along with my standard gear for those nimble moments when I want to reach for a super zoom but have the weight of a compact. And that's what I'm really looking forward to. So again, go to the article. There's more information too than I was able to talk about today about bridge cameras. And then take a look at the pictures. And if you have one of these stashed away, I know many of you do, right? I know many of you have some sort of bridge camera from 2014 or something like that tucked away. Pull it out, fire it up, run it through some of this software that we're talking about and see what you can get. As for my trip to Costa Rica, I'll let you know how it goes. Let's take a look at some of the industry news this week. And I have stories that somehow just magically sort of fall in line with what I've been talking about. This first one is on Petapixel. It is titled, "A Camera's Dynamic Range is Interesting, but Not That Important." Okay, now, first of all, I got to say, this is an article written by Jeremy Gray on Petapixel. I'm not necessarily saying yes or no to this, but I want to read you because I think it's interesting. When new cameras are announced, dynamic range is often a significant part of the image quality discussion. When a camera offers particularly fantastic dynamic range, it's big news. Likewise, when a camera's dynamic range takes a big hit in exchange for other impressive features, that's news too. However, does dynamic range really matter that much? In the latest episode of Adorama's video series, Ask David Bergman, the photographer kicks things off by saying, "Dynamic range? I say it's overrated." It's an explosive way to start a discussion about a huge, often confusing topic in digital photography. The discussion came up because the episode's question from Alyssa B, quote, "Whenever a new camera comes out, there's always a lot of talk about its dynamic range. How important is dynamic range really?" It's a great question, as Bergman says. There are some photographers who love to geek out about dynamic range, and it's a prevalent topic in online photography communities. I write about dynamic range a lot, and I take it into account when evaluating cameras. You can safely put me in the dynamic range geek camp. However, in many conversations, dynamic range is often treated like a stand-in for overall image quality. That's the wrong way to look at it. Dynamic range is only one piece of a broader image quality puzzle, and image quality is but one component of the camera's overall performance. Arguably, given how good every new camera is these days, image quality is rarely a meaningful differentiator between competitors. When photographers talk about dynamic range, we're talking about the range between the brightest highlights and the darkest shadows that a camera can capture in a single photo while holding some detail, Bergman says. It's a fairly broad definition, but it gets the primary point. Scientific dynamic range testing cameras determines the point at which the sensor's noise level and signal equalize and then measures dynamic range from there, typically in stops. There is subjectivity here, however. For example, William Klass' excellent resource, Photons on Photos, uses what Klass calls photographic dynamic range, or PDR. This is the resource Petapixel most frequently uses, as it seems more realistic and useful than what camera manufacturers themselves say, often boasting ludicrous claims about 15 plus stops of dynamic range. He then gets into some of the cameras that fall into this category of excellent dynamic range: the Sony A7 R3, the Canon EOS R3, the Leica M11. You know, they're all really terrific and have wonderful dynamic range. But then he goes on to say, it's easy to understand why photographers want cameras with good dynamic range, but the difference between good and great is very slim. What's more useful than a smidge of dynamic range is understanding how to get the most dynamic range from your preferred camera, which means shooting the highest quality RAW file at base ISO using an excellent lens on a stable platform, and then expertly processing the file. Yes, that's a lot of hoops to jump through, but for those who care deeply about overall image quality, there is plenty you can do in the field to improve technical aspects of your shots. And that's kind of what I've been talking about when working with smaller sensor cameras. I think you just have to have a bit more care, you know, working with RAW files, keeping the ISO down. When I was talking about the Lumix FZ300, I don't go above ISO 800 with that camera, because in my testing after 800, it was too difficult to recover the quality using software. At 800 or below, I could get the sort of image quality I wanted from that smaller sensor. The article wraps up with, in the end, dynamic range is but one way to measure the technological and engineering achievements of an image sensor, and I love that aspect of the photography industry. When a company develops an interesting image sensor, an image processing pipeline that delivers just 5% more dynamic range, it excites me, and I want to understand how it was done. But dynamic range does not equal image quality, and image quality is not the end-all, be-all of a camera. Good stuff there. And if you want more information, like I said, the link is in the show notes where he does talk about some of these cameras specifically. This woman invented the solution to lens flare. You've probably never heard of her, but every photographer should thank her. This is an article on Digital Camera World, and I have a link to the entire article in the show notes. This International Women's Day, I say thanks to Catherine Burr Blaguette, the inventor of non-reflective glass, crucial for stopping lens flare. Few women have had as big an impact on photography as Catherine Burr Blaguette. And I'm going to hazard a guess that you've never even heard of her. In all fairness, until recently, I hadn't either. But every photographer on earth owes Blaguette a debt of gratitude. Blaguette was an American physicist and chemist. She lived from 1898 to 1979, and her co-invention of non-reflective glass changed photography forever. It's hard to understate just how much of an impact her invention had, as its principles are still used in camera lenses today. In 1938, as an employee of General Electric, Blaguette and fellow researcher Irving Langmuir refined a way of coating glass with a chemical layer that enabled 99% of light to pass through it. This significantly reduced unwanted glare and reflections, and the principle has been applied to camera lenses ever since. To this day, the anti-glare coatings on our camera lenses still rely on the findings of Blaguette and her research partner. While modern non-reflective glass is typically coated in more durable materials such as magnesium, fluoride, and silicon compounds, the original layer-by-layer thin film technique still underpins non-reflective glass. That's a nice little history note there, and there's more about all of this in that article, including some pictures of the inventor herself. The importance of embracing imperfection. This is an article on f-stoppers with a link in the show notes to the whole thing. Modern cameras deliver images that are almost too perfect. Sharp edge to edge, clean color, flawless focus. That level of polish can leave photos feeling sterile when what you want is something human. Coming to you from Rotography, this thoughtful video questions what happens when technical perfection starts to work against you. Using a Sony A7 R5 and the Sony 24-105 F4G, Rose shows just how clinically sharp modern gear has become. Exposure is nailed. Autofocus rarely misses. Files are so clean that even at higher ISO levels, noise is barely there. You end up with images that are technically flawless, yet sometimes emotionally flat. That tension sits at the center of this discussion. Rowe points back to Robert Capra's D-Day images. They were blurred, grainy, shaky. By today's standards, many would have been rejected outright. Yet they carry urgency and weight. You feel the instability. The grip matches the moment. The contrast forces a hard question. If imperfections help define some of the most powerful photographs ever made, why work so hard to remove every flaw from current work? The video argues that chasing perfect sharpness and dynamic range can quietly strip away character. Okay, I want to interject here a little bit. I think it's good to have cameras that are capable of such wonderfully sharp, colorful, noiseless images. But that doesn't mean that you should always shoot or be focused on shooting at that maximum level of quality, for lack of a different term. And my thinking is that if you're so focused on that technical side, then are you thinking about the storytelling side? Are you thinking about the creative side? Is there room in your brain for both at the same time? That's my question here. So I'm not against cameras that have this fantastic quality, What I am thinking about sometimes is, do we always have to strive to maximize that quality with every photograph we take? And sometimes when we do that, are we sacrificing other aspects of the storytelling? Let me read you the last few paragraphs here where they give some examples. First, they talk about grain. Grain is another tool. Most spend years trying to eliminate noise, keeping ISO low, and using software to clean files. Rose suggests doing the opposite in the right conditions. On a gray muted day, raising the ISO to 1600 or 3200 adds texture that suits the mood. The grit can give weight to the clouds and edge to the shadows. On a bright sunny afternoon, it may look forced, so judgment does matter. The point is not to sabotage image quality, it is to use what was once considered a flaw as a deliberate choice. Vintage lenses enter the frame as well. Older glass often blooms highlights and softens contrast. Focus is manual. Precision takes effort. Adapters are inexpensive and options are endless. That slight haze or imperfect rendering can separate a subject from the background in ways modern optics correct out of existence. You slow down. You miss focus sometimes. You learn the lens instead of relying on autofocus to handle everything. Rowe also suggests revisiting early 2000 DSLRs with CCD sensors. Limited dynamic range, weak low light performance, colors that feel different from the current CMOS files. Constraints can shape style. When dynamic range is narrow, exposure decisions become more deliberate. When ISO performance drops quickly, light matters more. There is also broader tension in play. AI-generated images often lean toward polished perfection, uniform sharpness, balanced tones, clean surfaces. Choosing blur, grain, or slight misfocus becomes a way to assert authorship in a space flooded with synthetic imagery, giving your work a fingerprint that algorithms rarely mimic convincingly. That's something to think about, isn't it? So there is a video embedded in the article here from Rowe, and I think you would be interested in watching it if this sort of topic interests you. He gets into more detail than I covered here. Terrific food for thought, however, and kind of fits in our overall theme of the day. Let's take care of a little virtual camera club news. I only have two items this week. The first one are our wonderful Inner Circle members. Thank you so much, Inner Circle members, for helping support this podcast, this community, for helping us float this photographic boat. And in return, I try to take good care of you all as well, offering discounts and providing a wonderful space for you to interact with one another. An exclusive space at that. If you're interested in becoming an Inner Circle member, all you have to do is click on the Patreon tile that's on all the pages of the Digital Story. Sign up, and before you know it, you'll be hearing from me inviting you to our special space and offering you discounts on upcoming workshops. A huge thanks to all of you for supporting our community. And finally, a tip of the lens cap to our friends at Red River Paper. So I mentioned that making prints from this Lumix bridge camera worked really well. And it's sort of funny how the process of printing sometimes takes that character from the camera and puts it on paper in a way that we don't see it on a digital screen. I think that was the case when I was testing the TG7. And that's also been the case with the Lumix, with the FZ300. So printing is a way to further the creative look of the photography that you're doing. And printing works with your oldest camera as well as your newest camera. But yet the results are different and interesting regardless of which camera you use. And it's something that when you're exploring everything that you want to know about a camera that you're working with, make a print or make many prints from it. And I think you will learn more about your camera. And a lot of times you will have some assurance, especially when we're talking about these smaller sensor cameras, that, wow, I can go out and work with this because this 11 by 14 print looks fantastic. This is the kind of stuff that Red River Paper can help you with. They have a tile on all the pages of the digital story. Click on it, nose around a bit, get some paper, read some articles, and find out what your camera is capable of producing. And a big thanks to Red River Paper for supporting this podcast. All right, it's going to do it for me this week. I hope you enjoyed the show, working on more interesting stuff for next week. Until then, get out there, take some pictures, stay safe. See you next Tuesday. Bye-bye now.